The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from some past articles in the May-June issue of Sports Illustrated, as well as the July-August issue. We're going to begin on page 14 in the May-June issue, History, the Legacy of Title IX. 50 years after it was passed, the legislation has opened doors for women. In March 1972, the first women's college basketball national tournament was held. It was staged by the Association for Intercollegiate Athletics for Women, and won by Tiny Immaculata, a school of 750 or so students outside of Philadelphia. To raise the nearly $3,000 they needed to travel to Illinois for the tournament, players sold buttons that read, "We're going to be number one. We try harder." A month earlier, Senator Birch Bayh had introduced legislation that would go a long way toward creating a system in which players wouldn't have to sell knickknacks for the chance to compete for a championship. The act became known as Title IX. It compels schools to offer women the same opportunities as men. Title IX was signed into law that summer, but it had to withstand several challenges from administrators who were worried it would harm football and men's basketball programs. In the 50 years since, Title IX has succeeded in creating opportunities for women in sports. As recently as 1981, fewer than 30,000 women participated in college athletics. By 2021, that number was 219,000. And high schools have seen girls' participation increase by more than 1,000%. Of course, there is still work to be done. That was made evident in 2021 when pictures of the poor conditions at the women's Final Four went viral. But as former Texas Women's Athletic Director and Title IX advocate Donna LaPiano points out, there's still more sports than just playing, more to sports than just playing. A majority of female corporate executives, for example, played sports, helping them to acquire the leadership skills to break into the old boys' club. Says LaPiano, the cultural impact of equal opportunity for women in sport extends well beyond sport. Never heard of them. Professional sports seem like one big club. Tom Brady hangs out with Cristiano Ronaldo after the Manchester United game. LeBron James throws tight spirals to Dallas Cowboys stars in pregame warm-ups. You can name every athlete who's ever lived, so surely everyone else can too, right? Especially other pros. But it's not so. Here are some of the funniest circumstances in which someone didn't recognize or couldn't name a star player. I'm an example of somebody who went against what their team thought was best for them and stood up for what they wanted. I mean, there was a baseball player who was the first guy to get a Tommy John. Ichiro Suzuki. The Seattle Mariners legend had a reputation for many things, including a unique stretching routine and dry sense of humor. The former explains why Tom Brady asked Ichiro via text message for tips on keeping limber. The latter may explain why Ichiro asked his teammates upon receiving the text, "Who is Tom Brady?" with a bad word added for emphasis. Jack Eichel, the Golden Knights. Star arrived in Vegas after a falling out with his original team, the Buffalo Sabres, about what kind of neck surgery he should get. Eichel preferred a procedure no NHL player had ever undergone. The Sabres ultimately blocked his ability to choose that operation, and he held out until he was traded to a team that would let him. Justifying his decision later, Eichel cited whomever was the first pitcher to get Tommy John surgery. We'll give you a hint. It rhymes with Jami Tan. 100-plus assists in an NHL season has been accomplished only 13 times. 11 times by this player. Poor Joe. Sometimes Jeopardy. Contestants skip questions that seem obvious to us. Obsessive sports nerds. But jumping in with the wrong answer can be way funnier than admitting defeat. A contestant named Joe buzzed into the above answer with, "Who is Magic Johnson?" before Diane gave the obvious correct response. Some simple advice. If it's a hockey player, guess Gretzky. If it's an abstract Dutch painter, guess Mondrian. Kobe Bryant, believe it or not. Believe it or not, an NBA legend, Kobe Bryant, spent much of his childhood in Italy, where his father played professional basketball there. His European upbringing led to his speaking fluent Italian and apparently having no idea who Michael Jordan was. To be clear, by the time Bryant was in American high school, MJ was winning rings, so we heard about him then. Deion Sanders. After primetime called Tyrann Mathieu the best safety in the game in 2018, Titans defensive back Kevin Byard took exception on Twitter. Sanders replied, "You're looking at who writers tell you who's the best. I know who players and former feel is the best. You continue to be a fan, and I will continue being the man." Let's hope Sanders genuinely confused Byard for a fan. How the mighty. Some of sports' most hallowed records could be broken in the coming years. Others will become even less attainable. Here's who has a shot to rewrite the history books. The king takes the scoring crown. It's a matter of when, not if. LeBron James will break Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's record of 38,387 career points. Barring an injury, he will probably do it next season. That a Laker will be breaking another longtime Lakers record would only make the moment that much cooler. The NBA's all-time scoring title is a strange honor. How many younger fans knew that Karl Malone had sat in second place behind Abdul-Jabbar for more than 20 years until James overtook him this season? Yes, the point of, no pun intended, of basketball is to score. But the unwieldy five-digit nature of the record makes it hard to remember and even harder to calculate James's distance. And the GOAT debate has never been LeBron versus Kareem. In some ways, this is like being Major League Baseball's career runs leader, Ricky Henderson, with 2,295. Bill James, the father of sabermetrics, once said of Henderson, "If you could split him in two, you'd have two Hall of Famers." LeBron James figured to split it into at least 10. NHL career goals. The greatest eight. The great eight, 95. The most impressive part of Alexander Ovechkin's potentially breaking Wayne Gretzky's mark of 894 career goals is how far away he is from every other Gretzky record. The great eight isn't halfway to the great one's 2,857 points, and he may soon be the NHL's active leader in the category. Gretzky's stranglehold on hockey's record book is a case of the sport's best player reaching his prime in a high-offense era. NHL teams averaged 4.01 goals per game in 1981 and 82, the season Gretzky had 92 goals and 120 assists. For most of Ovechkin's career, that average has hovered around 2.7. It's a testament to the captain's longevity that's even unthinkable. He'll reach 895 career goals. Comparable goal scorers like Mike Bossy and Pavel Bure retired in their early 30s. Two factors work in Ovi's favor. The league is scoring more in general, up to 3.12 goals per game this season. And his wicked one-timer means he'll keep lighting the lamp even if his legs slow down. NFL regular season coaching wins. Take them to Shula. Patriots coach Bill Belichick has 31 playoff wins, 9 conference titles, and 6 Super Bowl rings, all record for NFL coaches. But in the regular season win column, Belichick, 290 victories, trails Bears legend George Halas, 318, and longtime Miami coach Don Shula, 328. Halas coached until age 72. Shula retired at 66. Belichick will be 70 this season. but you would know it watching him. Something about the sleeveless hoodie makes him seem young. Assuming the Mac Jones era goes well, it should take Belichick about 3.5 seasons to be the new boss of bosses, or he could retire as the GOAT before then. No other active coach is even close to his number. Andy Reid is second with 233 wins. NFL career yards in the long run. Like pitching in baseball, NFL rushing attacks have changed so much that certain records seem unbreakable. Teams pass more than ever. Still, a handful of modern running backs, including Chris Johnson and Adrian Peterson, have come near Eric Dickerson's single-season 2001 mark. Emmitt Johnson's 18,355 career yards, however, seem farther away than end zone from the opposite one-yard line. Even Peterson remains over 3,000 yards short. Smith himself has singled out Tennessee's Derrick Henry as one player who could challenge his record. With 11,558 yards to go and already 28 years old, Henry would probably have to play well into his late 30s. If he rattles off a couple more 2,000-yard seasons, however, we can reassess his chances. USWNT goals. Alexandra the Great. The United States women's national soccer team functions like any other American sports dynasty, perpetuating itself by handing down responsibility from one generation of superstars to the next. Abby Wambach led the USWNT to 3 straight Olympic golds. Her 184 golds are the most among United States players. Alex Morgan is the active golds leader for the United States with 115. It's doubtful she'll get enough caps to challenge Wambach. However, she didn't play for the United States team in this year's She Believes Cup. When asked about the absence of her and her other veterans, Coach Vlatko Adanovsky said, "There's a reason Mia Hamm is not in camp," suggesting the team is focusing on a youth movement. Major League Baseball strikeouts. Chasing the Ryan Express. It's an unstoppable force approaching an unbreakable object. Strikeout totals are increasing, but so are injuries for pitchers. Will anyone have the durability to challenge Nolan Ryan's 5,714 punchouts? Lately, Max Scherzer has been striking out more hitters on a per-inning basis than Ryan ever did, but he's barely more than 50% of the way to the record. More likely, Reggie Jackson's hitter record of 2,597 Ks falls first. NBA career threes, tortoise in the facial hair. It would be the ultimate tortoise in hair story. Stephen Curry shattered Ray Allen's career three-point field goal record 2,973 this season. He could easily reach 4,000 or even 5,000 trays in his career. He is the only player in history to hit 400 in a season. But James Harden ranks third all-time with 2,593 threes. He's more than a year younger than Curry and, with no NBA titles under his belt, might have the motivation to keep going after Curry decides he's accomplished enough. Also working in Harden's favor is his durability. Curry has already missed most of 2 seasons in his career with different injuries. Harden has played in 150 more games than Curry despite their debuting in the same year. Now, the good news for Curry fans, Harden's three-point attempts are way down, 6.7 per game in Philly, from his Houston days, 13.2 per game in 2018-19. As long as Steph Curry plays basketball, he figured to have 10-plus tries from behind the line in most games. What if teams merged? Crummy teams will do anything to get better, including getting worse. And though tanking has become popular, there are other options. An owner with deep pockets can try to spend their team out of obscurity, or an executive might target their organization's culture. Really, fixing a team is no different than fixing any other kind of business. So why don't owners use one of the classic strategies for growing a company, buying another? Why don't franchises ever merge? Believe it or not, it has happened before. During World War II, when players left to fight overseas, NFL teams merged as a matter of survival. In 1943, the Eagles and Steelers combined to form the Steagles, not the official name. Then in 1944, the Steelers teamed up with the Cardinals as the Carpets. Carpet, get it? Two struggling NHL franchises, the Cleveland Barons and Minnesota North Stars, merged before the 1978-79 season. Two seasons later, the Franken team would reach Stanley Cup Finals and lives on today as the Dallas Stars. What if? There are impediments to the modern merger. Rival pro leagues with easily acquired teams are less common, though the USFL and XFL plan to return soon. And even if two organizations were daring enough to try it, there were sure to be objections from fans and rival owners instead of fixating on why it won't happen. However, let's imagine if it could. Which teams would benefit from a mashup? And could anyone ever stop the name Steagles? The London Jungle Cats. The idea of moving the Jaguars to London has been kicked around for years. Ever since Jacksonville plays a game at Wembley Stadium as if to prepare for the British fan for the possibility. But after 8 games in the UK, the Jags remain in Florida, where attendance figures are poor. The Lions have similar issues drawing fans, and the problem may become permanent. Detroit is one of the fastest striking cities in the United States, or fastest shrinking cities in the United States. The fit makes sense on the field. The Lions have some exciting young weapons on offense, and Amon-Ra, St. Brown, T.J. Hockenson, and DeAndre Swift, but no franchise quarterback to get them the ball. They won't find a better passer in the draft than Trevor Lawrence. The plan is simple. The Jaguars contribute Lawrence in a map of London. The Lions bring everything else, including their classic silhouette logo. The teams combine their gold and silver color schemes to commemorate the series coin or quid, as the Brits say, they'll be making soon. The New York Rats. It is ironic that the Rays have a reputation as one of the best-run teams in baseball, despite the lack of resources. Or was it inevitable? Maybe spending less forced them to create a great front office because they have no margin for error. Either way, their success is undeniable. From 2008 to 2021, Tampa Bay had a .545 winning percentage. In that same span, the Mets' record was just .487, but new owner Steve Cohen has spared no expense in making his team into a true custom rival for the Yankees. You see where I'm going with this? Why spend $250 million on a player payroll trying to copy Tampa when the entire Rays franchise is only worth around $1 billion itself? So buy the Rays and bring all their brilliant statisticians in their ways. Fertile Farm, always Fertile Farm, system into the Mets organization. The Mets' blue and orange color scheme is an amalgamation of its National League NYC predecessors, the Giants and Dodgers. This time they combine four-letter names to make the Rats. The popularity of these oft-aligned rodents has never been higher. Thanks to charismatic subway dwellers like Viral Pizza Rat and Master Splinter. And in sports, rat is almost always used as a compliment. Gym rat, rink rat, etc. The rest of the league will hate them for making a super team, but they'll own it. Rats don't care what people they think of them. The whenever, wherever Hornets. The Charlotte Hornets moved to New Orleans in 2002. But were technically designed as an expansion team. So Charlotte, which no longer had any players, retained its record and history as the Hornets, but not the Hornets' name. The city wouldn't have a team again until 2004, when the Bobcats were born. Then the original Hornets changed their name to the Pelicans, so the Bobcats would become the new Charlotte Hornets, while also somehow already being the old Hornets. Are you confused? So am I. So let's make them even more confusing. Let's really combine the old Hornets and the new Hornets into a single franchise. Now the record books will show that the Hornets played in two different sets of games. in two different cities around from 2004 to 2015, which is already kind of the case. In addition to both simplifying and confusing the franchise history, the merger makes best basketball sense. Charlotte's crown jewel is LaMelo Ball. New Orleans has Zion Williamson and is desperate to build around him. The Hornets can bring the guards Ball and Terry Rozier, while New Orleans or Hornets can provide the size Williamson, Brandon Ingram, and Jonas Valanciunas. That's a starting five as good as any in Hornets history, whoever's claiming it these days. Your team name here. Before I start combining NHL teams, I think I've done enough to anger fans in Florida, Michigan. I tried to have more than three states mad at me at one time. So if you'd like to take care of some of the heat off me, submit your merger team idea to Art Gallery or Kip. You know our email address. Now to our July-August issue. Page 40, the WNBA veteran rookies. This season, more than a half dozen players at least 26 years old, all with international experience, have made their debut in the WNBA. Rebecca Gardner had been in the United States for just 4 days when she was inserted into the Chicago Sky's starting lineup on May 11th against the New York Liberty. The 6'1" guard had recently wrapped up her season with the Uni Girona in Spain, missing all of Chicago's training camp and logging just two practices with the reigning WNBA champions before suiting up against New York. The abrupt turnaround is why on the morning of the Sky's eventual 83-50 victory, Gardner told coach and general manager James Wade she was surprised by his decision to have her open the game. But despite her admission, the rookie guard also felt ready for her first WNBA contest because, well, she isn't exactly a traditional rookie either. Gardner had been playing professional basketball for a decade, having completed in Israel, Turkey, Romania, and Spain. Since finishing her collegiate career at UCLA in 2012, at 31 years old, Gardner became the oldest rookie to start in her WNBA debut since 2003. That definitely means a lot, she says. It's hard to explain in words. She's not alone in being a veteran of professional basketball, but a former in the W. Through the end of May, across the line, there have been 7 debutantes this season who are at least 26 years old, the most since 2001. Three of them, Gardner, teammate forward of Tina Krajicnik and Connecticut Sun guard Yvonne Anderson, are in their early 30s. We have the talent, and now we're finally getting opportunities, says Anderson, who turned 32 in March. So you just want people to root for us with the same vigor they root for younger players. We all want to play at the highest level. Anderson, like Gardner, has carved out a successful career as a basketball nomad. The daughter of St. John men's basketball coach Mike Anderson, she admits she was a little spoiled by the resources provided by the University of Texas, which she played 4 seasons. A primary example came after graduation when Anderson moved to Sweden. While there, she remembers relying on a bicycle to get around, recalling one particular incident when she was riding to a grocery store, but fell. I face planted trying to make a left turn during a snowfall. I guess I could have been smarter for not riding the bike in the snow, she says. But it's not something that I was used to. The sport has subsequently also taken her to Australia, Luxembourg, Greece, Turkey, and most recently Italy. Magical moves. After a decade in her native Japan, the 29-year-old Machida is dishing out 3.6 assists per game, second best on the Mystics. Anderson, also a naturalized citizen of Serbia, having played by a key role on the team's fourth-place finish at the Tokyo Olympics last summer. Such experiences not only helped her game develop and raise her profile with WNBA front office, but also introduced her to much of the league's top talent as a large switch of players go abroad when the season continues. Roughly half the league's athletes played overseas in 2022. I know we could play basketball at a really high level, says Anderson, who played 13 minutes in her debut versus the Long Island and the Sparks on May 14th. And what better way by working more time to learn myself and to grow? That's why I'm here. Why at 32, I'm getting the opportunity now. End zone. Number one. Hit parade. Kip and Whitney are playing Liz and Penny in spike ball. After Whitney bounces the ball hard off the net, Liz and Penny both dive and knock it into the air simultaneously. Penny then gets back up and hits to Liz, who knocks off to Penny, who bounces it off the net and past their opponents. Kip and Whitney complained that Liz and Penny hit the ball four times. Liz and Penny argued that a simultaneous touch counts as the rest of their three allowed hits. What's the rule? Do, 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 do. Simultaneous hits are counted as two hits in spike ball. Liz and Penny touch the ball too many times and lose the point. Aim for the stars. The West End Stars are playing the East Side Queens in kickball. With a runner on first, the ground ball comes to Najima, the East Side shortstop. Najima looks to get the force out second, but notices the second baseman, Anton, is picking dandelions in the outfield. Najima bends to run toward the base, but realizes she won't beat the runner. As her opponent goes to slide, Najima throws the ball, banging him in the head before his foot can reach the base. The Stars complains that she can throw the ball at his head. What's the call? She can't throw the ball at his head. What's the call? Two, throws to a runner's head or neck are illegal in kickball, except when the runner slides or intentionally uses their hand to block the ball. In this case, the runner is out. We've run out of the time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.